looking at the debate on origins. So I will change my port. Maybe that will help. Reboot it. All right. And as we present, I've got black screen all over the place. Now, as I present this, it'll be, hey, look at that. I'm going to be asking our church family to be thinking about how we can present this to the larger public. So it may be elementary for you, maybe things that you have thought about a lot and have kind of the answer already in your head, possibly. But there are a lot of people out there that don't have the answer. And so starting with elementary becomes important if we want to look at things that are more complicated. And so this morning I want to jump into this, and I'm going to do, you just kind of know what's going to be coming up for the next 6 months when I'm up here to preach. I'm going to be looking at this, and you see on the screen the six segments, at least a little clue what those might be about. And today, we're going to look at the origin of the debate. Be thinking, as I talk, how you might be able to take my place as we present to the larger community. So you may, in fact, be much more competent and capable of talking about this than I am. We have some scientists in the room. We have some medical personnel that have thought a lot about this. And it may be that this would be a great opportunity for us as a church to reach out to a larger community. So here we go. So the origin of the debate. So and my notes would be nice. There we go. So you may have noticed that science and religion are oftentimes couched as in conflict with one another. So if you are a scientist, you can't really believe in religion very well. If you are someone who believes in religion, you take everything by faith, and science for you has very little value. And this isn't really the way things should be. In fact, I believe that science and religion actually can be in harmony, since I believe that the Creator God who created everything is the creator of science, and we worship him through religion. Now, we find in popular culture, we see these things on the back of cars. I think the first one was the one there on the right, Jesus. And then people wanted to respond to that. Well, it's not Jesus that created that fish. It's Darwin. So they stuck a couple of feet on the bottom of them and changed the name. So, in 2017, there was a Gallup poll that asked people what they believe about creation. So, and here on the left, we've got a recent creation. So, 38% of the people that were polled believed in a recent creation, meaning that a divine being created. It didn't happen over millions of years, and this is really kind of the biblical worldview of creation. And then I'll get to that one in just a moment. And on the other side, we have natural evolution. So 19% of the respondents believed in natural evolution, meaning that things started from a single organism and have progressed to the amazing complexity we see today. Most of that 9% is made up of young people. And in the middle, we have this theistic evolution. Theistic evolution believes that God created, but then he left the whole thing to an evolutionary process. So he created the start that deals with that great big problem of where do we get our beginning, but then evolution takes over and we have where we are today. Science cuts it off there. Sorry about that. Comes from the word scientia. So it's a system of acquiring knowledge using or based on the scientific method, as well as an organized body of knowledge gained through research. It's helpful to notice the two parts of the definition of science. Okay. You have hard science. So hard science is testable. It's something that can be observed. It's something that and can be predicted. Hard science is sometimes interpreted using current models and a worldview, but it's always a testable science. So in school, we're doing an experiment with Mr. Ground. We're doing some hard science, and we're looking at how the salt and ice interact to create things that are colder than the ice was when it started. And we ate last Wednesday the product of that as we made some ice cream. We discovered that if you just use ice by itself, you don't get ice cream in the ice cream maker. You get still the liquid milk. But if you had salt, and our measurement was how much salt, and we collected data and we wrote it down and we're writing conclusions, that is hard science. It's repeatable. But then you have historical science. And historical science is not the kind of science that you can do in a laboratory. Okay, it's not testable. It's not something that can be observed or predicted. Historical knowledge is always subject to the favored models and worldviews. Okay. So here's an example. So I generally teach history. I like this example. So there's a fact. So that the pilgrims came to America in the 1600s. Okay, that's a fact. What were they seeking? What were they seeking? So you could say, some might say, that they were seeking to take away the land from the Native Americans. Or they were seeking religious freedom from an intolerant Europe. Or it could be something totally different. Or it could be everything, all of them. The historian's answer may tell you more about the historian than it tells you about the pilgrims. Okay? So the answer to what were they seeking is a clue as to what the historian is thinking. If facts are facts, why don't we all agree on everything? I've wondered that from time to time. Here's the answer. Data does not equal interpretation. Okay? We all have a worldview. We all start with a worldview. Okay? And our worldview is our faith framework that we use to interpret or make sense of our world. You all have one. You can't help it. So it's formulated by where and when we are born, our parents, our education, our experiences, our culture, all of these combine to give us a sense of meaning in this world. So there are five questions to be answered. One, who is your supreme authority? Okay? In other words, it's the place where we go to help us make understanding of things, to give us the ability to make sense. Who's in charge? Okay, what's in charge? So it could be science, that is our supreme authority. It could be God. It could be something else. It could be many things. Number two, where did everything come from? And this is the question when we talk about origins. So it all got to start somewhere. Where did it start? So what is your place in this world? Maybe even a better question is, what is your place in the universe? As we get a picture of our world and we are able to get farther and farther away and we look back at our world, I don't know if you've ever seen the pictures of the pale blue dot. It's kind of a disturbing picture. Because as you see in that sea of black out there, speckled with little white lights of stars and galaxies, and in that picture is this little tiny dot, and that's where I live. Every place else in the universe, as far as I know, is hostile to my existence. But if I can stay on that pale blue dot, I have a place. I have a spot. Okay? But beyond that, what is my role? What is my place even within that? Part of my worldview. So what is your moral code? Why do you do what you do? What is right? What is wrong? Okay? Who decides what that is? What are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? Our moral code will define that. And this, what is your future? It's kind of a big one, actually. Your worldview defines what you define your future will be. Okay? As a Christian, as a Bible-believing Christian, I can say my future is looking pretty bright. Okay? Even when things are looking pretty dim in my world, so my future is looking pretty bright because I have a worldview that says there's going to be great things that happen in the future. Okay? Not everyone has that. So here's an example of a worldview that clearly interprets this. I don't know if you guys have ever been to John Day Fossil Beds. So raise your hand. Have you ever been, anyone ever been there? You should go. So it is the best thing happening in Central Oregon. As far as I can tell, it's the only thing happening in Central Oregon, but it is good. Okay. So there was a minister who first studied and promoted the fossils in the 1800s. He became Oregon's first state paleontologist. Okay. And he was discovering out there marvelously preserved fossils, mostly mammals. In the John Day fossil beds, not many dinosaurs in there. So as they uncovered these, they found lots and lots of mammals. And as he studied that and promoted that, it really increased the nation's understanding of life. And this man was a Christian minister. There he is, Thomas Condon. Here's what he writes. The hills from which these evidence were taken, he wrote in reference to the evolutionary record of the fossil beds, were made by the same God who made the hills of Judea, and the evidences are as authoritative. He added, the church has nothing to fear from the uncovering of truth. He also said evolution was simply God's method of working, and therefore not atheistic or infidel. So where would he fit in our three things? If he was around to take the poll, probably right in the middle. Theistic evolution. Okay. Worldview. So what was Thomas Condon's supreme authority? Any ideas? So that was the first question we asked under worldview. In other words, what made him, what did he go to define the evidence that he saw? Is the hard fact, the hard data, is that in the rocks and in the strata of John Day fossil beds there in Central Oregon are lots and lots of bones that can be dug out and put together, and lo and behold, we have mammals of all kinds. So if you're, you know, if you're wondering, there's even some saber-toothed cats, and those are pretty cool. So they really were around some point in time. Okay, so but mostly a bunch of mammals that we would recognize today, and they're all buried out there in the strata. So that's the data. And so what was Thomas Condon's supreme authority? When science and the Bible conflict, what was his supreme authority? Even though he was a minister, his supreme authority was the popular science of his day. And he had to try to blend those two, to try to make it work for him. Our worldview helps us interpret a lot of things. Our understanding of suffering and wars. Different views of what that might be like. Worldview. Our understanding of science and religion. Our understanding of origins. Where did we come from? It might even help us understand the esoteric questions of life of what came first. So, the chicken or the egg? Our worldview ultimately defines who we see God as and what his role is in our world. 1998, a poll of members of the National Academy of Sciences, a group of thought and policy leaders in science education. Okay. It was asked, do you believe in a personal God? 7% said yes. Okay. Do you disbelieve in a personal God? 72% said yes. Are you not sure? Agnostic? Could go either way. I doubt it. 21%. So, probably you should look back on that. In case you're doing the math, it doesn't add up to 100%. Right? So it's because some people don't answer. That one does. Next one won't. Anyway, we have 93% of the people that are thought leaders either aren't sure or disbelieve a personal God. Do you think that affects their worldview? Do you think that that one thing right there is going to be really significant when people start interpreting the data? Are they going to come to the same conclusion that I might? But ironically, science actually has some of its greatest leaders in a world that had a different worldview, and they came to different conclusions. So Isaac Newton. So no sciences are better attested than the religion of the Bible. As we look a little further, in the 1200s, universities in Europe like Cambridge, in the picture behind me up here, only taught that God had created the world, like the Bible said. And for centuries, all graduates tended to think the same as their professors. Today, universities in the West only teach that nature or material created and organized everything that we see. And now, almost all graduates tend to think the same as their professors. So as we have people coming out of university, we have people that believe, that have been taught and believe that nature has organized itself into everything we see. Worldview. So science operates using models. Okay? They're sometimes called theories, but they're operational models, which are difficult to change. They are meant to help us understand what we see. A pioneer in the subject of changing models was this guy, Harvard PhD physicist Thomas Kuhn. So in the mid-1900s, he wanted to understand, he wanted to see if he could understand the way the Greek philosopher Aristotle interpreted nature. If you remember from your science classes, Aristotle believed that all the world was made up of four elements. So there was fire and water and earth and air. It's a funny thing that shows up in popular theories today. So Aristotle was that was the basis for his thing. So here in the mid-1900s, this guy Thomas Kuhn says, "Can I get into the mind of Aristotle and understand why he thought that way?" And he did that with a very specific goal in mind, because he wanted to understand how models change. Because we don't think that way anymore. We've got a different way of looking at the world. We don't see things in the way Aristotle did. And Thomas Kuhn wanted to understand, what is it that makes things change? He ended up coming up with a couple of terms that we use fairly common today. That's paradigm, the way of looking at things, and then paradigm shift. When things change, when my worldview changes, what causes my world to change? In the Middle Ages, you had another view that was really popular. If you can't see that word, it's alchemy. And every monarch had an alchemist that he paid to be on staff. It's kind of like chemistry, but different in a very much of lots of fundamental ways. And the goal of an alchemist was simply one thing, and that was to turn lead into gold. Now, lead and gold share a lot of commonality. In fact, if you know the periodic table, they're right next to each other on the periodic table. But they're both soft. They're both heavy. So the difference is, you know, lead is dangerous and gold is not. So if we could turn lead, and lead is common and gold is not. So if we could figure out how to turn lead into gold, then we're going to have, we'll rule the world, because we can get lots of lead, turn it into gold, we'll be able to buy everything we want. So they didn't really think about economics very well, because if you do that, gold will become just as valuable as lead. Not the other way around, but I diverge. So that was a model, that was a theory, and it never did come to fruition. We have never ever figured out how to turn lead into gold. Here's another model to consider, and maybe you've heard this one. So some people think this is an electric light bulb, but perhaps it's not. Perhaps it's a dark sucker. As soon as you turn on the switch in a room, electricity flows through this bulb, and the bulb sucks all the dark out of the room, and therefore the room appears light. So darkness is sucked into this little bulb, and eventually this little bulb fills up with dark and can no longer take any more dark in. And here's one that's full of dark. So that's one way of looking at it. It's interesting how one can come up with a different model that sort of explains things pretty well, but unfortunately is wrong. Okay. So models on the subject of origins and how nature operates are very critical, especially in the subject of whether or not there is a God involved. Notice this comment by Richard Lewontin. We have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow the divine foot in the door. Materialism, in this particular instance, is not talking about owning a Mercedes or having a bunch of stuff. Materialism is the science, in the science world, is the idea that material is all that there is. Yeah. Material begets material. There is no supernatural unseen forces like a creator God involved. That's why they cannot allow a divine foot in the door, because they want to maintain their model. They are sticking to their model. Have you heard of this guy? Richard Dawkins. He's a world-famous atheist biologist at Oxford University. Well, he used to be. He's not around anymore. He said that biology is the study of complicated things that gave the appearance, and so that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Scientists will agree that things we look at seem to suggest they were designed. There is complexity to it. They appear to be designed, but they prefer a random origin that includes a series of fortunate accidents. Have you heard of this guy? Francis Crick, a Nobel Prize winner, said biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. They have that commitment for not letting the divine foot in the door. Their worldview will absolutely not allow it. The human mind is such that when it looks at some objects, like this rock formation here, it understands random forces could have, in fact, created or shaped what we are looking at. It doesn't take much imagination to expect that the wind and the rain and erosion that somehow shapes random things like this, and depending on the hardness and anything, a whole bunch of things we can consider in that, it's going to erode at different rates and it's going to create some shapes. But when we look over at something like this, we wonder, can random forces really form this? It becomes a little bit more complex as we see the design and structure. The biggest and most fundamental science question of all is always will always reveal a worldview. So how did life appear? When you talk about life, there's a wide variety of understanding of what life even is. And here's a definition from Webster's. A principle or a force that is considered to underlie the distinctive quality of animate beings characterized by a capacity for metabolism, growth, reaction to stimuli, and reproduction. Yawn. But honestly, there's really no consensus regarding what the definition of life is. We've got life in all sorts of forms. And it may even have several forms. Not just different animals, but plants, and fungus, and bacteria. Perhaps if life did not appear, it could have appeared multiple times in forming multiple things. One of the most obvious big questions is, how did life arise from inorganic matter? No one knows. It is that right there is a big rub. So which is why theistic evolution becomes a real popular thing. So I can't answer that question. Why did life show up? How does inorganic matter suddenly come together and produce life? Perhaps God created the life and then left us all to evolve as we see fit. It's a really popular view. Here's another one. Did life come from outer space? If I can't quite figure out how life started here on Earth, there are some really honest and intelligent people out there that believe that. So that life originated somewhere else and arrived here on this planet through aliens, through maybe a planet that blew up that had life on it, and parts of that planet arrived here and started life on this planet. Or maybe a meteorite landed and on it were the basic elements of life, and then evolution takes over and we get the wonderful complexity that we have today. When I first heard this theory, I was puzzled how an intelligent person could go here. But they do, because, and here's why they go here. Because if you're not going to allow the divine foot in the door, and you have life on this planet, you have to eventually come up with some theory and some reason how we got here. And this, if I don't allow for God anywhere in my story, this starts to seem plausible. Because nothing else seems plausible. So I will take even some of the most outlandish ideas if I want to keep God out of the story. So that's one view. Here's Louis Pasteur, as a famous French biologist. He tackled the subject of where life came from, dealing with a theory that was really popular in his day called spontaneous generation. And he conducted a series of experiments that he came to the conclusion there is no known circumstance in which it can be confirmed that microscopic beings came into the world without germs, without something else, without parents similar to themselves. This disproved the popular theory of spontaneous generation and led to the framing of the biological law of biogenesis. Okay? Everything comes from something else. Bio, life, genesis, beginning. So, the beginning, you have to start with life. Today, most all scientists believe in abiogenesis. When you put an A at the beginning of it means the opposite. So not life at the beginning. Life came about via natural chemical processes from a hot chemical vent or pool, and they would disagree with Pasteur's law, which is interesting. Yeah. So remember, we're talking about the difference between hard science and historical science. Okay? So if I'm talking about what happened way back at the beginning, can I recreate it in the lab? Well, let's see. So if abiogenesis happened, it was because of chemistry, not biology. And here's the basic reason of that. Because we're talking about before anything alive was happening. So if life came from that hot pool or that early environment, it was a chemistry thing, not a biology thing. And so what if we create an experiment? So the Miller-Urey experiment of 1952, and it looked a little bit like this. So if we have a heat source down here, we've got in our container over here, we've got H2O, CH4, NH3, H2, and if we shock that thing and we give it a good jolt of electricity, much like we might get from a lightning strike, what's going to happen? And Miller-Urey expected that they would be able to produce life. Well, they didn't produce life, but they did produce something interesting. They produced amino acids, which are the basis for the proteins and the basis for creating a cell and life, ultimately, if we could take it far enough. So the science world cheered. Yes, we have done it. We have, in fact, been successful. Look, it could have happened. Unfortunately, as people looked at the experiment further, they found a number of things that just didn't work. People have concluded that if we had this environment way back, it didn't actually look like those chemicals. And so the whole experiment has really been put into the bucket of disbelief. But people still look at this and say, well, what if we could create it? So far, no luck. So we start to ask questions, and this is from The Guardian, August 31, 2013. So how did the basic chemicals presented on earlier spontaneously arrange themselves into something resembling life? How did we get DNA? What did the first cells look like? More than half a century after Stanley Miller proposed his primordial soup theory, we still can't agree on what happened. Maybe it came from the bubbles in the primordial soup. 1665, Robert Hooke first saw and identified the human cell. They reminded him of rooms at a monastery, so he called them cells. By Darwin's time, it was thought they contained mostly protoplasm, which is a jelly-like substance. Michael Behe, is a biologist, he points out, now it's the turn of the fundamental scientists of life, modern biochemistry, to disturb. The simplicity that was once expected to be the foundation of life has proven to be a phantom. Instead, systems of horrendous, irreducible, which means you can't get anything smaller and have it work, complexity inhabit the cell. And the more we study and the more we look at the cell, the more amazing it becomes. It's a whole city of functioning machines and pathways and everything happening inside the cell. And it's all happening inside of a little container that I can't see with my naked eye. But as I get my microscope and I zoom in and I get closer, I discover that more and more things are happening inside of that little micro cell that I can't see. Huh. There are 40 trillion cells in our bodies, 200 different types and functions. So if there's a pothole that science usually runs into, it's assuming that things are more simple than they are. The perfect storm for evolution to arise in the 19th century looks like this. So the weakening of the Bible, biblical standing. So in the 19th century, people introduced the idea of higher criticism. The Bible is simply a collection of books written by humans that try to explain their world, and it is not the divine word of God. This was taught not only it was taught in the theology schools, it was taught all over the place. The discovery of key fossils, dinosaurs, Neanderthal, and I meant to look up this word, and I'm not sure how to say it, so I'm not going to try. Archaeo something, Terex, maybe. Okay? So the Archaeopteryx is an interesting one. I'll just pronounce it that way and probably get it wrong. It has this blending of wings and a long skeletal system. It looks like it has a tail. It definitely looks like it's this blending of different kinds of things. And people looked at that and says, obviously, that is the missing link. They discovered further and further dinosaurs, and they said, wow, look at it. Looks like things are put together. And then they discovered the Neanderthal, and they were convinced this is, and you still hear it today, this is an early form of human. This is where we evolved from. In the 19th century, there was an ignorance about the complexity of genetics, the growing belief that the world was perhaps millions of years old. And we got this guy. Let's skip ahead a little bit here. So he wrote a book, Origin of the Species. Actually, I had a longer name than that. But he was a naturalist who headed out and went on a round-the-world tour to do some mapping. And as a naturalist, his goal was to look at the natural world. And he started out with a general sense that maybe millions of years were in fact a reality, and as he looked at the data, his worldview interpreted it. And so as he got to the Galapagos Islands, the sailors were buying tortoises to eat, and they weren't eating the shells. And so Darwin got the shells to look at, and he noticed that they were different. And the islander says, "Oh yeah, every island has its own shell." Huh, interesting. And then he looked at some birds. Okay? And he noticed that there were some similarities, but they were all different. You had birds that had these great big beaks that could chew on seeds. You had smaller ones. And the islanders again says, "Oh yeah, every island has its own kind of bird. They all live, each island has its own thing." So Darwin went back, and he wasn't very good with birds. And so he began to ask around, and he discovered, when he was back in England, all the birds were in fact finches. Well, how could it be that they're all finches, but they have these different beaks? And he came up with the concept of that they, based on what they eat, they have the survival of the fittest. And so those that could eat more were able to breed more often, and so you had each bird was unique. Okay? The natural process by which organisms best adjust to their environment are most successful. Okay? So they went from that, and he says, well, perhaps if we take these little changes over enough time, we will in fact get a big change. And we'll go from just what we call microevolution or adaptation to this grand evolution where we get a species change. If I give enough time and I get enough changes, I'm likely going to get that. At least that was his view. You need to see this. It's because this is really important. So this is the name of his book. It wasn't just Origin of the Species. By means of natural selection or the preservation of favored races in the struggle for life. Tell you what, this is a whole different topic, but as you look at that, this book is fundamental to a whole bunch of things that we put as really nasty in our world. The idea that there are favored races got adopted, and both here in the United States and abroad, and ultimately the big name that we throw out there that really latches onto this and says, wow, that must be how things work, is Nazi Germany. And that whole favored races thing became really the basis for what they had to say. And they got it straight out of this book. And the United States. But another time. Darwin contributed a theory of how evolution worked. However, since survival of the fittest doesn't change the genetic code, all it does is makes things more fit. A new theory has emerged that does change the genetic code by mutations. And this is called neo-Darwinism. However, there are lots of problems with that theory. Mutations never produce a benefit. They always produce a problem. And as things mutate, they don't become different, they become worse. This guy, Dennis Noble, all the central assumptions of modern synthesis have been disproved. And we could spend some time with this. I'm actually going to skip ahead because our time is limited. So this runs a little longer than what we have for our morning. So by faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command. So what is seen was not made out of what was visible. Hebrews 11:3. If we look into Acts, we see Paul, who spends time in Thessalonica. He gets run out of town in Thessalonica. He spends time in Berea, gets run out of town in Berea, and he is taken by boat, and he arrives in Athens by himself. And as Paul spends some time walking around in Athens, he discovers that the Athenians are very, very religious. So they are also very scientific. Okay. So it says, now while Paul waited for them in Athens, his spirit was provoked within him when he saw the city was given over to idols. Then certain Epicurean and Stoic philosophers encountered him and said, what does this babbler want to say? So, you have the Epicurean philosophers followed this guy, Epicurus, and he basically said, everything, so the gods are not involved in the world at all. They're too busy having fun. Mankind shouldn't worry. We should continue just having fun. That's Epicurean. Okay? There is no afterlife. The Stoics follow this guy named Zeno. It says, God is in nature, not above it. Man's happiness comes from overcoming wrong attitudes through increased knowledge. There is no afterlife. So a Stoic would study to know and understand the world around him. And that's all there was. And here comes Paul. He seems to be a proclaimer of foreign gods because he preached to them Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new doctrine is really about. And there's a picture of it there. That's where they were standing. And Paul goes on and says, men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For as I was passing through, considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you, God who made the world and everything in it. Since he is the Lord of heaven and earth, he does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything. Since he gives to all life, breath, and all things, we ought not think that the divine nature is like the gold or silver or stone, something shaped by art or man's devising. Truly, these times of ignorance God overlooked, but now commands all men everywhere to repent, because he has appointed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by the man whom he has ordained. He has given assurance of this to all by raising him from the dead. And here's the reaction that he got. And when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked. Yeah, it's nuts. The Epicureans and the Stoics, none of them believed. They were very scientific, but none of them believed in the resurrection of the dead. That didn't make any sense at all. But Paul pointed out a being that made heaven and earth, a creator who gives and actively maintains the life of all creatures. He pointed out someone who can't be contained in temples or properly represented by man's reason or art. Has there ever been a picture that is completely understood and got the picture of who God is? No. A divinity above natural laws and fully capable of suspending them at will. And a God with whom we are responsible. However, some believed. Their worldview changed. They had a paradigm shift. So as Paul was speaking, they go, that makes sense. That answers questions that I've had. The world of a creator God. Alistair McGrath, although I was passionately and totally persuaded of the truth and relevance of atheism as a young man, I subsequently found myself persuaded that Christianity was a much more interesting and intellectually exciting worldview than atheism. So, Wernher von Braun was the man mostly responsible for, through NASA, so for putting this in space. Religion and science are sisters. The one seeks knowledge of creation, the other, the creator. So it may be this morning as we look at things that you may have like, oh, I've heard that so many times before. Okay, that could be. But our world is in this conflict. Who are we going to recognize? Who are we going to see as our ultimate authority? And our schools and our universities are too often promoting a worldview that is non-biblical and ultimately leaves out all the important stuff. Do we have a way of speaking to those people? Do we have a way of reaching out to them? I think we do. You know, we don't have to put science away and tuck it away and say, okay, it's just faith. And we're not going to stand on science and say, okay, science is the only answer. If we do that, we start to elevate science to a level that it was never, ever meant to be. And at the risk of sounding political, our world has done that, and we've gotten some really odd responses from science. So, for the last couple of years. I'd like you guys to consider, as we close up, how can we reach out to our community, reach out to the larger world around us, and present the very fundamental, one of the very fundamental things of the three angels' messages, so that we worship a creator. Let's pray. Father in heaven, this morning as I talk about things maybe people have heard many, many times, maybe it's new, maybe there's more, I ask that you help us to just solidify in our mind that you are the creator and that we don't have to turn off our brain in order to recognize that. Help us to find ways of sharing that with other people. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, sing our closing hymn. That closes out, it does. Thank you for whoever was praying over the technology. It worked all the way through. Appreciate that. Thank you. What are we singing? I don't have my bulletin in front of me. The Wonder of It All. 75? All right. Let's stand as we sing.
There's the wonder of sunset at evening, the wonder of sunrise I see, but the wonder of wonders that thrills my soul is the wonder that God loves me.